Hello guys, welcome to Beyond the Wall. This is your host, Cavernario, and with us is Beto from Venezuela. Say hi, Beto.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the ACLU podcast.
Well, as you heard, Beto has a lot of echoes, as usual. And with us is Kurt Doolittle. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Beyond the Wall.
Beyond the Wall. How old is that name? Did you just make that up?
No, that's the name of our show. We have a podcast in Spanish and in English. The one in English is called Beyond the Wall, since we are beyond the future Trump's wall.
God. Okay.
The pun also on the Game of Thrones whole screen.
It works. It's funny. People like it.
Yeah, it's also, as he said, it's also a pun from Game of Thrones. And we've used it when we talked about
Now it makes sense. Now it makes sense. Okay. All right. So what are we going to talk about today?
We're talking about a little bit about proprietarianism, which is a philosophy I think you came, you've been developing since I don't know when.
A long time.
Yeah. And we're also talking about peaceful ways to collapse the system.
Mm-hmm.
Since I heard you were interested in that.
Well, I'm not sure I'm interested in peaceful ways.
Well, there can be peaceful ways. That's what's interesting.
Oh, yeah, but it's not as fun. No, but yes, to be serious, sure. I can speak seriously about it.
Yeah, since I think you're living in Ukraine right now, if I'm correct.
Actually, I'm staying with family right now because
okay.
I took my startup to the very edge, and now I'm trying to finish it off. So we're almost there, but I'm gonna do that from here in the States. A little bit easier. It's just anyway. So let's go ahead. So that's all. But I'm staying here. I hope to return to Ukraine at some point in the near future.
Well, since we were talking about violent collapse, that's an example.
I don't know. I mean, Ukrainians are pretty passive, like most Eastern Europeans are pretty gentle people. It wasn't terribly, there was a little bit of violence against them, but mostly they threw a lot of rocks and set a lot of stuff on fire. I actually thought it was, on both sides, it was an example of restraint. It's quite beautiful. Anyway.
Well, good. Good to hear then. Okay. So can you give us a short introduction to proprietarianism?
Yeah, you know, giving a short introduction to proprietarianism is one of those things I keep trying to do and it's quite hard. I'm just going to say it this way, is that I started out in about 1992 with the objective of trying to create a rational and scientific language to talk about what I considered then conservative, but with Christian or Western European values, and our ancient culture. I wanted to talk about how that worked and why that worked, and I wanted our people to be able to argue their positions in rational terms. Well, you know, I worked on this for quite a long time. In 2006, I did a draft and realized how ignorant I was. By 2009, I think I had put together the understanding of how to put together a government that would force us to be honest with each other, because I see honesty or deceit or pseudoscience as perhaps the way we're being conquered now, we're defeated. And the same way we were defeated by, you know, supernaturalism in the ancient past, we're sort of being defeated in the present by pseudoscience. And so I wanted to be able to counter this, to find some way to allow us to be able to talk about it. And then by about once I got my draft done in 2009, I understood that there was a particular problem. At that time, I thought it was... I referred to it as calculation the ability to, to not be precise enough in the construction of policy and law. And so I started working on the that problem. And around 2012, I think, I began to understand that it was possible to solve, but that I had to solve the problem of what's truth. Now, that sounds like, angels dancing on the head of a pin kind of thing. But with some significant amount of work, I was able to put truth into scientific terms. So, let me just finish that, okay?
Yeah,
before
sure.
we go on a side, because I'm almost done. And so, what happened over this time, I went from starting out with a very simple idea, which is to create a sort of rational scientific language, all the way to creating a full formal philosophy that sort of unifies philosophy, morality, science, biology, and this is sort of like the holy grail of philosophy. And I just sort of stumbled into it by doing a lot of hard work. And what does that mean to us? It means that we can talk about political systems truthfully and morally and immorally, whatever. We can talk about them comparatively and make absolute rather than relative judgments about it. We can say this one's better than that one objectively, this one's not as good, etc. We can make those statements. And so propertarianism is that philosophical system. The second part of my work is what do we do about it? And that's the how do we restore Western civilization? So if we can talk about things rationally, then what is it we do? And that's the other half of my work, is what do we do about it, which is now that we know what the philosophy of Western civilization was and why it worked, how can we restore it? Anyway, so that's what propertarianism is. It's a philosophical system that tries to think of it as it allows you to speak about social matters with the same degree of precision we speak about the physical sciences, and then to compare them, and then to lastly to use that knowledge to talk about how to restore our Western civilization.
That's great. That sounds great, actually.
It's actually insane. No one, if anybody went out to try that, you'd never set about trying to do this on purpose. You have to sort of stumble into it. So, Wittgenstein tried. He did his first book. He spent much of his life realizing it was wrong, wrote a second book. Kant spent 10 years writing his. Hume and Smith, they spent great periods working on theirs. Darwin spent many years on his. I don't think Darwin set out knowing what he was doing. He just sort of understood after a while that this has had to be published. And I sort of did the same thing. And I just stumbled into this, is how I look at it.
They stumbled upon several truths at different times and ages.
I think what's behind Western civilization actually is that we're looking always for the truth with a capital T.
Yes.
And we want to have a truth is our highest virtue, I guess. And I think. And have you ever heard, have you ever heard about Jordan Peterson?
Of course I know him, yes.
Yeah, okay.
He's actually had quite a bit of success. Unfortunately, he went up with went in an argument a couple of weeks ago, and he kind of fell on his face.
Sam Harris?
Yes. And because he broke one of the cardinal rules of Western civilization, and that when you speak the truth in our civilization, that means truth with a capital T, and the way you speak the truth is that you avoid all conflation. In other words, you don't do what every other civilization does, which is mix religion and law, or supernaturalism and testimony, or the narrative vehicle and the statement that the narrative vehicle is true. We don't do that. In fact, the one of besides deflationary truth, that's what it's called, by the way, is this category of truth that's a very specific. It's called deflationary truth because every other kind is sort of conflationary, and so in the West we always have been deflationary. We've always kept law and religion science and myth, and we've always kept these as separate disciplines. Somebody's echoing me now.
Yeah, that's better again.
So what Peterson did with Sam Harris, which Sam wasn't going to let him go by for his own reasons, not that he probably understood this question of deflation or truth or not, but he tried to do was conflate mythology, spiritualism, and truth, which is speaking truthfully. And he's saying, well, if it's good, it's true. And I'm like, no, that's not true. It's something is true or false, and it's or true or unknown or false, and something is good, ambivalent or bad. But and what we would like things to be is true and good and beautiful, right? That's truth, goodness, and beauty. We'd like all those three things to interact. But you can't say that something's just because something's good, it's true. I mean, there's plenty of good things that are false. There's plenty of false things that are bad. There's plenty of good true things that are bad. We don't conflate those two. And so he violated a basic principle of truthful speech, which was to conflate truth and goodness. And this is where he got himself in trouble. And this is because there's a difference between teaching, right? When we want to convey or teach or inspire other people, we do conflate. Matter of fact, we have to conflate because there's no way for me to transfer to you or someone else to transfer from one person to the other. We can't transfer meaning unless we input all these other experiences around it. But once we've transferred meaning, then we have to say, well, now let's cut to the truth of it. So now that we've figured out how to envision this thing, now let's get rid of the falsehoods that it took in order to get to that vision. And so what the difference between eliminating falsehoods and communicating meaning is that you try to bring people together with meaning, but you try to resolve differences, disputes with truth, right? I mean, with only the truth. And so what happened is that he got into an argument and he tried to say that meaning was true, and it's not. It's just meaning. And Sam kind of chewed him up, and I thought Peterson fell all over himself. Unfortunately, Sam doesn't really know enough how to – he didn't understand what was going on well enough. He just could say, well, I don't know how to go from there if we can't agree on what true is. I don't know how to have a conversation, which is correct. If you can't agree on what true is, if somebody wants something false to mean true, well, you can't really have any conversation from there on. And so that aside, Peterson's largely right. He's largely right that our old myths have been intentionally suppressed by the left, particularly the Frankfurt School and critical theory under the Marxists. And he's right. And the new mythos is that of victimhood. And so, whereas in the old world, we were told that we were, given all this mythological background for our sort of sorry state of affairs. Now the new pseudoscientific, critical theory has put out the pseudoscience that everybody's in their position because they've been oppressed. Well, the truth is that Western civilization didn't. People might consider it oppression, but we domesticated the human animal for fun and profit for 3,500 years. And it turns out that's a pretty good thing if you do enough of it.
Yeah, so, I think it's the only or the main eugenic civilization. Improving ourselves at least 3,000 years.
Yes, easily. And especially over the past you know, certainly over the past 3,000, up until 1900, you know, we were hanging 1% of the half to 1% of the population every year. And, you know, you hang one in 100 troublemakers every year. You know, you run out of troublemakers pretty fast.
Yeah, that gene pool for violent behavior gets smaller and smaller.
Gets smaller, smaller. So, moreover, you have a second problem which helped, which worked, is that you have not only dangerous or problematic people on, impulsive people on the one hand, criminals, but you also have unproductive and lazy people on the other. In other words, they're not doing anything positively harmful. They're doing things that are negatively harmful. So you have a lot of lazy people. And so what happened in both Asia, East Asia, and here in Western Europe, was that, you know, you starve to death if you behave like that. Because we had our version of manorialism, and the Asians had their version of manorialism. But, you know, you can sort of make it through on wheat, but rice is a 360-day-a-year job. So, you know, they killed off a lot of people, too, and they're more merciless about it than we were.
Well, they have almost no empathy.
Yes, they're brutal, well, really. I mean, their history is horrifying when you look at it. So when we get down to this, you know, we've been domesticating people for fun and profit. And by the time we get to, you know, the early 1800s, you know, there's, or even the late Middle Ages, there's almost nobody left in European society who isn't the descendant by and large of what we call the genetic middle class, not the economic or social, but, you know, somebody who has basically domesticated personalities. And so we ended up, you combine that with the study of the reawakening of science, you know, and then, the reawakening of Greek thought, which allowed us to graduate from Aristotelian reason to the Baconian empiricism. And, you know, we got science and then we got books and we just flew. So it was pretty amazing progression. But now, let's flip it around and say, well, what's the real problem for the world that doesn't do that? It's one thing to look at ourselves and be proud that our ancestors were basically farming human beings, you know, and trying to get rid of the bad ones and domesticate human. But what if the problem is now, what if your people aren't productive enough to create a hierarchy of market incentives that can allow them to organize into some kind of beneficial production? This is the problem that a lot of the developing world has had, is that, yeah, well, you know, when the Europeans got all the low-hanging fruit, and then now we're in a position where, you know, sure, the Europeans were able to make use of moving labor, then moving labor to the clerical classes, from the clerical classes to the calculating class, managerial classes, from the managerial to the calculating classes, and now we're into the scientific classes. So, but the rest of the world doesn't have that low hanging fruit. So, what do you do if you're? I mean, you guys are in Mexico and Argentina, but I always think of Brazil. You know, it's pretty hard if you're Brazil. I mean, how do you produce something of enough value that you can organize your people into a market if you're slanted on the downside? In other words, if there's just too big an underclass to organize by market means. So,
one thing and I'll tell you a meme we have in this show that you cannot have a market means of for Latin America, not for Mexico. And I think Mexico is one of the better ones besides Uruguay, I guess, and Chile.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree.
But you cannot have it because the Indian population is a Southeastern Asian population.
Yes, correct.
And they are a low IQ population, not as low as blacks, but low IQ population.
Mm-hmm.
And they also need a dictator to lead them, always.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always they're used to following strong leaders. Actually, they're very good. They don't have any. Sorry.
Go ahead. I was going to help you. I was going to elaborate on your argument, but go ahead.
Yeah, they don't actually, Indios are, they don't get, they don't, they're not good at revolutions or anything like that, but they're very good obeying people, and they like to obey people.
Yeah, I've been surprised at them, actually, what I've learned. Unfortunately, you can't trust the data that the Americans produce. So I prefer to get data from down there, and there's just not enough of it. And so, but what I see is pretty good. You know, the problem you have, which is correct, is that the problem for guys like you is, how do you create a polity that's a wealthy when you have to drag all that behind you?
Well, you need to have a system similar to either to a medieval aristocracy or a strong dictatorship, mm-hmm. like they had in Chile with Pinochet. Or Mexico had a very successful dictator in Porfirio Diaz 100 years ago.
The problem with dictators alone, in other words, dictators alone, is that when you say, I'm a dictator, you say, I'm unlimited in what I can do. I kind of like to use the monarch, the king. Because if you are limited in what you can do, you know, this is the value the church provided for Europe, is that if you, the kingdoms were tended to be really small, so if you got out of line, you could get the papacy could act like a judge and say you are no longer, you know, holding up your end of the bargain, and then, you know, five of your neighbors would go steal everything you have and get rid of you.
Well, that's how it worked with the right-wing dictatorships in Latin America. Since Latin America was very Catholic and it still is, right-wing dictators tend to be Catholic and they have some fear of God in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see them, they're not that extreme. I mean, Pinochet killed like 4,500 people or something like that of communists. That's nothing. Porfirio Diaz during like 30 years of dictatorship killed about 10,000 Mexicans. That's nothing. I mean, to conserve the dictatorship.
On the other hand, if you took what he did and you said we could write this down as law, in other words, so that it wasn't discretion. In other words, it wasn't his will that he did. It was that we knew how to say these people are bad. I don't know who's knocking on some. Can you turn that off?
Sure, that's better.
Hi, Kurt. I love you.
Hey, man, love you back. you know, my view is that we easily reach for what we understand, but it's possible to create a rule of law that licenses that kind of behavior against people who are communists. In other words, there's no reason why the government shouldn't put these people to death. I mean, I always say we don't kill enough people. There's no reason the government doesn't do that. It's rather that we have to write. It's better to have in a constitution, you will be killed if you do this, than it is to leave it up to, because we don't want men inventing new things that they can do.
Yeah, and we don't want a dictator that turns left wing and commie after we've had a run.
Or who makes them, I mean, I always got this thing with Putin, you know, he's the richest guy in the world now, really.
Probably,
Yeah, and you know, and I'm like, well, you know, honestly, given how much good he's done for Russia, I kind of, you know, it's hard for me to argue. On the other hand, and then in order to rule Russia, you need money. In other words, you need this stuff.
You need like I was saying in Latin America, you need a strong man.
You need a strong man, but you also need money. It's expensive to rule. Yeah. You know, and so when it's your money, you are not in a position where you're begging for mercy from other people. And this is the same thing I think of monarchs, right? And so one of the reasons I like taxes going to the king is that he can spend them how the heck he wants. He can build commons if he wants to, and he can punish troublemakers if he wants to.
He has skin in the game because he wants to inherit his sons.
Exactly. So the monarchy was a much better deal, and I think that if you say, well, when you say dictator, I say that's what that says to me is, hold on, I want to finish this statement. What I said, this says to me and most people would, I think, mean a person with discretionary ability in the creation of law, and I think that's wrong. I think when you say a monarch doesn't have discretionary ability in the creation of law. He has a discretionary ability in the punishment under law. And so I think that the problem we have is that our laws aren't severe enough, that and our monarch, we need to return to monarchs with severe enough laws. And so what I've tried to do is I've tried to articulate how we can produce severe enough laws that for all intents and purposes, we have an unopposable, in other words, fascist, I use the word fascist in its non-technical sense, a fascist government in the sense that you can't do these leftist things, or that just even talking about them is a crime, right?
You're going to ride in a helicopter.
Right. And so if you even try that, that's helicopter rides. Whereas in our country, we've had this long and foolish record of, quote, freedom of speech. Which has turned out, you know, which was invented back when, you know, all you could do was, print a few pamphlets with a hand press, right? I mean, when what we really need is, what happened is we got to the late 1800s and all of a sudden, then we got media, you know, got electronic media, and they've basically industrialized the process of lying by the product propaganda. We call propaganda. And so if we're going to industrialize that process, let's regulate it. The way we can regulate it is you say whatever you want as long as it's true.
You know, it's funny because shit lips, liberals always say that, you know, First Amendment, it was meant to, you know, it was written when guns were muskets, which is not
yes.
All these other amendments like the First Amendment. Like yeah, it was done when before we had massive communications and TVs and four conglomerates owning everything and just weaponizing lies.
Yeah, that's right. I agree that we should modernize. But what the left wants to modernize is they want to eliminate rule of law so they can impose discretionary law in order to destroy markets. Whereas the right wants to impose law. To eliminate discretionary law so that the only choice is to participate in markets. Now, if you want to say, well, markets aren't entirely possible for an economy where we have too large of an underclass that doesn't have a high enough set of abilities. And I would say, I agree. So why do we need a monopoly economies? Why can't there be Soviet-style labor economy for maintenance of the commons, you know, all the stuff the Soviets were good at. Why can't there be a union, set of unions for some of the laboring classes? And why can't there be a market for the people who participate in the markets? Because really, that's what us are capable of doing. So my problem is this whole what I view it as is that in order to seize power during the Enlightenment, so to speak, or not, I view it the next big great lie, is that everybody tried to say, well, we need a monopoly rule. We don't need monopoly rule. The great thing we had with the church versus the state is we had a competition. The great thing we had with multi-house. The monarchy, the House of Lords, the House of Commons, and the churches, you had a house for every class. And damn, it was hard to get everybody to agree. And so
yeah,
we had
the guilds had a lot of power.
What?
And the guilds used to have a lot of power back then.
Yes, the guilds had power. So the problem we have is we don't have, we've sort of gone for this monopoly, which is basically 150 years now, people have tried to make excuses for seizing power. And where the whole history of the West and the reason we didn't fall into the trap that India did, that Islam did, that China did, we didn't fall into that trap of stagnation, even though we were way poorer than they were, is that we didn't fall into it for the simple reason that we kept innovating all the time. We didn't build a monopoly anymore. So, we got a bunch of people talking about rights and this crap, and it's all a bunch of excuses to try to seize power instead of to create representative organizations, representative economies that allow us to cooperate based on what we actually have going for us. You know, the left wants to create a total redistributionist state, a peasant state, and the right wants to create a purely market state. Well, frankly, those are both attempts to build a monopoly. Libertarians want to create a pure, perfectly market state. That's just another monopoly. Why do people need production? People need economies. In other words, they need to be able to work together in an organized method to produce common goods. And for personal consumption, but they need to be able to do it with the talents that they were born with. You know, we can't assume everybody's going to join the aristocracy.
He will need a system of syndicalism, as you said, the Falanges had in Spain.
Yes, but we need to stop trying to make them monopolies, right? We need orders, economic orders that suit the needs of the people, of different people. You know, I want to work in a market economy. I'm sorry, I'm a professional. I'll always be a professional. I want to work in a market economy, but I totally understand the guy that says, I want to work in a syndical economy. Understand.
You have an IQ above 130, so...
It's easy for me, exactly. So, but that doesn't mean I think everybody should be like me.
No, I agree
with
you. I mean, for people like us, we have a higher IQ. You have a higher IQ than me. But for people like us, we can function in any system, pretty much.
That's right. It doesn't matter where we are. And it's unfair to tell people, everybody, they got to do like us. It just means they're afraid and stressed out all the time.
Yeah,
I remember in a sociology class back when I was a libertarian, the professor was actually right. This was like one of those weird instances where an associate professor, she wasn't a complete Marxist, said that, because again, this wasn't the United States. This was in Venezuela, so she wasn't an acolyte of Dildolek, as we call it. You know about Dildolek, right, Kurt?
Sure.
Yeah. No, but so she was going over the some scenarios, and I remember I very naively says she put some very like, well, you know, what happens if this person falls under this disgrace or this accident happens to him, and I remember she was like, okay, so what do you do? This is why you need the safety net. I remember very very naively just let her say like, well, why doesn't he just start his own business? Like, yeah, okay, yeah. So like, as if everybody could start their own business and just compete in the market. And it's like, no.
No, it's actually hard.
It's hard. One of the things that I don't know if it's a completely original idea from you, Kurt, or if you synthesize it from somebody else. But this idea that the left actually has some value in the sense that they value comfort. And we just need to trade with them. We don't need them to have a monopoly in the government, because then everything is about feelings and everything is about, you know, nobody can be uncomfortable anytime, anywhere. It's very harm-based, government morality. Mm-hmm. But we can trade with them, because we don't also want to become sort of like Warhammer 40K, as cool as the aesthetics are. We don't want to have a universe where, well, what about if I just want to relax one weekend and just just be comfortable for one weekend. Yeah. No, I have
but
to be always.
Don't hold a gun to my head and say you deserve it.
Yeah.
Instead, say, what will you trade me for it? Right. All right. What I want in exchange isn't money. I don't want work. What I want is you to be fucking a decent person in the commons. Right.
Right.
You know, that's mostly what we want, actually. I mean, and it's what it's in, what an increasing number of people can't abide. I mean, what do you do when you're saying to people, I want you to act walking down the street like you act in church or the library? And if you can't do that, then you need to not be on the street.
Right.
And now, that's actually, you know, what the church actually trained. One of the primary values the church did is they taught us sacredness, and they taught us to be sacred in public. And so we've lost that. And now these freaking animals are running around saying that they have the right to be impulsive. You know, I'm saying, okay, well, great, you have that right. Well, then I have the right to deprive you of my production, because that's, we're not engaging in a trade anymore. You're just saying you're right. You have a right. Well, you know, don't have that right, because you can't have it. So here we go. What do you want to trade? If you want your day off, or you don't want, you know, whatever it is, we want you to behave. And that's mostly what we care about. I mean, honestly, we want to be able to trade. You know, it's like the conservatives here in America, we're like, we can get, we'll trade you all these things, but we want to get rid of the Department of Education. But they won't trade because they want all, or they want it all.
Right.
We're happy to trade. You know, we're happy to give up stuff in order to get what we want. We hope we're happy to buy people. You know, the problem is these people want it for free. They want to be able to, you know, live a world of impulse and emotion. They're, because they're not human yet. They're still animals.
Well, I would say they don't want it for free per se. They just want to exercise violence against to get it from them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they don't even, they're not the ones exercising violence. It's like violence by proxy. It's like, oh, I'm going to use the state to take what I want from you until we say no more.
I can't get in people's heads and reduce it to that. All I know is that in my world, people use every technique at their disposal in order to obtain what they wish. And when in the end, what almost everybody's doing is merely fighting on behalf of his genetic predispositions.
Gene machines,
or just gene machines, and everything else is just all the whole. Most of our head is just a negotiating box. It's like one of those little automated teller machines from the 1800s. Give me 1 second. I want to pull my headphones off for 1 second. I'll be right back. Hold on.
Sure. I actually gotta be right back. Me too.
Okay, there we go. We're just gene machines.
Yeah. Well, the main part of our brain is the reptilian brain. That's what actually, if we are not obeying its commands, we can do anything. I mean, we have to first feel safe, be fed, and then we can start thinking about anything else. But we're actually very primitive machines in that sense.
Yeah, we have this wonderful box sitting on top of that reptile that learned how to negotiate with other super predators. And, I use the example all the time of crows. You know, crows are a lot smaller than we are. They have very small brains, but damn, they're basically smarter than most of the great apes. And why? Because their social life is so difficult. So that's what, you know, that's what our social lives is, as the great apes who could run. You know, our social life turned out to be pretty complicated.
Well, yeah, we are the most social animal besides ants, I guess, or bees.
Well, yeah, the problem is, it's hard to say you're social when you're not an individual actor. So we're capable of individual action just fine. It's just we're not very successful as individual actors. I don't know. I always look at it and say, well, you know, dogs are the closest thing I know of to us in that regard. They wolves, you know, wolves, dogs, whatever. Yep. They're the closest thing to us. But anyway, so what are we getting at? We're having a lot of fun. I know that much.
No, we were talking about we started talking about what the problem with Latin America, that a market system wouldn't work per se in Latin America.
A monopoly system won't work.
Yeah, a monopoly system won't work.
It won't work, and you know the problem is you're not going to put in a non-monopoly system under democracy, which was created in both the Greek world and in the modern world as a means of seizing monopoly power. So it was a means to overthrow the prior market order of politics. So the problem is you're not going to get with democracy, or at least the way democracy is constructed today, you're not going to get that unless you explicitly put out a constitution together and say, well, the limits of democracy are those that are specified in this constitution, and it's helicopter rides for anybody who gets out of it.
Besides that, it only works with high IQ and high trust white people.
Well, or we could just say that a group of people who've been heavily domesticated to the point where, you know, the pedomorphic evolution, in other words, the domesticated process that makes intelligent, peaceful, rational people, has just created enough of a majority that they that they can create a full economy, you know, society, economy, government, out of their numbers. The problem for you guys in South America is there's just not enough of you.
No.
Compared to the other side. I mean, just there's so many. I mean, and imagine what it's like in the Muslim world or Southeast Asia.
No, and then they have a dysgenic system.
It's a catastrophe down
it's
there.
It's even worse. I mean, they probably had a better system 1,000 years ago.
Yes.
But after 1,000 years of dysgenic evolution, only the most violent and rapist of rapists and such have passed their genes in their civilization.
Well, I don't know which one we're talking about, but certainly in the Muslim world.
Yeah, in the Muslim world.
They've, you know, first... I am not anti-African. I'm pretty pro-Africa, actually, and I have a lot of hope for them. But, you know, you bring in 10% of people with 70 IQs, and you breed with them. You do it long enough, it's over. And then in order to keep property inside your families, you marry first cousins almost exclusively, or at least in the majority of people do in the 40-50% range. You're going to get what they got there, which is the evil 80s. You know, people with 70 IQs actually aren't all that problematic because they know it. The problem with 80s is they know it. They know they can't get out of it, and they're angry about it, and they have enough IQ to do something about it.
Yeah, and a lot of them have high testosterone.
Yeah, yes, and they have high. So we've got impulsive, early maturing, low verbal intelligence, and that's why they love that freaking religion, man. It's you just recite that stuff over and over again, and yeah. It's
well,
like
I don't think Africa has a future for Africans because the Chinese are going to conquer Africa. And...
I think the Chinese are gonna. The Chinese have always had a Middle Earth policy, which is that the Han. Are you know what we probably should be? They're terribly racist.
Oh yeah,
and they're completely aware of it. And
yeah,
I
live a year and a half with them.
Yeah, and so on there, you know, you look at the Han, the Koreans and the Japanese, and that's a pretty good gene pool over there. And they're protecting theirs, and we're not. And yeah. And we're not because we let women in power. And, you know, they get mad at me when I say this, but I mean, it's just the voting records that we'd never have this problem if it hadn't been for women voting. And yes. You combine minorities, women voting, the socialist movement, the post-war. Well, I mean, we had a coincidence of catastrophes that were just impossible for us to overcome as a society. We could have easily done if we hadn't gone in on the First World War, probably. But
But those coincidences tend to echo.
Yes. Women did not evolve to tell each other the truth. They evolved to just feelings and get what they wanted through feelings and I want to say manipulation, but it's not like they do it on purpose. They it's like you say, they always had you add your biological imperative, and they just did not evolve to. Trade
well,
between
have,
themselves.
Well, compared to the physical strength of a typical male and a typical female. I mean, how could they compete
I think we should look at it honestly. Is it we hurt the first animal we domesticated and herded was women,
right?
And we killed their males to steal them, just like we killed other men to steal their cows. And everybody gets really pissed off, and I'm like, well, you know, I my job is to be the guy who tells you the uncomfortable truth. I don't happen to like it either, actually. It makes my relationships really uncomfortable. But, you know, if I look at how we look back and say how we evolved, that's how we evolved. The men are pack animals, and women are herd animals. And that's because that's how we evolved. We evolved not because we evolved as small groups who preyed upon other males in order to get territory in their females. That's it. It's not complicated. Okay. And our women have inherited, you know, exactly what they need.
And Beto, were you going to say something?
Yeah, well, females are, for the purpose of the survival of the species, at least from a biological standpoint, far more valuable than males.
It's true.
They do have it. I think you agree with me on that one, Kurt.
Of course.
Oh yeah.
But the ostracized, you know, ways that, well, one of the ways in which you can actually win back the West is that if you condemn the bad males into reproductive ostracism by a couple of generations, they will be exterminated because they won't have any progeny.
That's right.
Well, that's what the church used to do.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. The church used to control female reproduction, right? Like if you didn't get married, you couldn't be a suffragette, or you had to become a nun or something. Go to the church, but it was always about controlling reproduction. It's like if you're not gonna be under your dad or your husband, sorry, you gotta be under the patriarchy of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it worked.
Anecdotally, I can say that my marriage got much better when I stopped enabling my wife and just setting limits, and yes. Learning how to become a man, because we are raised by our mothers right now. We are not, and I mean, it's not like I was raised by a single mother, but my dad never explained to me. He never explained women to me. I had to figure it out on my own.
Well, look at the school system. It's made up for women, not for men.
Right, society today is made for women, not for men.
I mean, primary school and high school and everything like that is made up for women. It's better for women because they're better at sitting and doing nothing, just talking. Especially at that age, we're kids. We need more physical interaction and et cetera, et cetera. We need physical punishment also.
Well, and you see it in the whole westernized education system, in which boys to behave like girls, to stay put and stay quiet. You have this
be docile.
And you have this pandemic of ADD, which does exist, but not the proportions in which it is diagnosed. ADD is a medical condition, but it's overdiagnosed, and it's overdiagnosed to pump a kid full of Ritalin so he can actually stay still, you know. There's a whole war on boys since they're little boys in order for them to, you know, become these sort of modern day emasculated males with no sense of masculinity, with no sense of how to establish a character and a moral character persona. They completely lack these skills and these means for them to actually function as males. So what you get from that is that the whole herd-like mentality is injected into a human being, into a living organism that is programmed by its genetics to behave otherwise. And nature doesn't work that way. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So where are we going here?
I think we can go ahead with the anecdote. I was going to tell you about how to collapse the system kind of peacefully.
Well, you were going to tell me what happened
in Mexico.
What happened there?
Yeah. Here in Mexico, I have to do a small introduction. The price of gasoline is set up by the government because the oil company, there's a monopoly on oil in Mexico. And it's owned by the government. The company name is called Pemex, Mexican Petroleum, or in Spanish will be Petróleos Mexicanos. And the price of gas in Mexico is very expensive. And then on January of this year, the president decided, because they've had a black hole on the budget for several years, and to avoid a crisis, I guess, they decided to put to get the price of oil 20% higher in one day. We got a price hike of 20% in gas prices. So now we're paying about almost a dollar for a liter of gasoline. And that hit pretty hard for most.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. So that hit pretty hard with for most people. And a lot of people started doing a kind of rebellion against the government. And they took in a lot of cities, the people just started taking the railroads and closing the highway system. And if you close the highway system and the railroad system, also the Petróleos Mexicanos offices in all cities, so the oil company could not deliver gas to the gas stations, gasoline. And what happened is that after 3 days, small cities ran out of food.
Wow.
After like 5 days, medium-sized cities and small cities ran out of propane gas. And in northern Mexico gets cold, not as cold as other places, but we do get -5, -6, mm-hmm. -10 Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
And most people use propane to heat their houses.
Mm-hmm.
So when you run out of propane we run out of propane on 4 days and food, the big cities didn't run out of food because wow. the protest only lasted for like 6 days. But if it had run for like 10 days, most of the big cities would have run out of food.
Correct.
And that's it. I mean, the government couldn't function because also there was no gasoline. So a lot of the police stopped patrolling because their patrol cars had no gasoline.
Yeah, this is why I say that we live in the most fragile era in history and that it's built entirely on momentum. In other words, our whole economy depends
on
momentum. There aren't any stores. They consider that, quote, inefficient. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not inefficient to have a year's worth of food. It's pretty inefficient. It's not inefficient to have a year's worth of gasoline. It's not a year, you know, there are things that it's not inefficient to have. It's probably not necessary to have so many extra headlights for your Toyota Prius. But, you know, there are things that need to be, that there's no value in efficiency because you're just trading for risk. Also, you know, we could look at this two ways. We can look at this as, wow, this is terrible, or we can look at it as an opportunity. Of course, my opinion is it's an opportunity because it's incredibly simple to bring down governments today.
Yeah, and for us in my city, mm-hmm. it's a city of 1 million people. About 500 people took the city.
Yeah, it takes nothing.
It took nothing to almost stop a city of 1 million people.
Yeah. Well, you know, it depends on what you're willing to do. I mean, I've said for a long time now, if you have, you have a few dozen men who are willing to make infrastructure not work, which is basically electricity, communications, and then you water, and then you make it impossible for those things to be repaired, and then you start working on just making the roads difficult to get around, making it difficult for police to police them. You don't have to do this for very long. In a very short period of time, a city becomes ungovernable.
Yeah.
Now, my view is that you don't need to do this nationwide. You need to do this in one or two or three select cities with some with not too much effort. And that's a small number of men. If you really want to make change, there's not really much they can do about it.
Yeah.
They're actually, in other words, there's people in the government who do this, and that's why they've taken so many precautions to arm and to build up arms in the federal government, because they know this time is coming.
Remember when there have been several cases like that, but I think somebody started this. I think it was the Chinese or the Russians were doing it to study how the system copes with that pressure. That they were attacking power stations in California.
I don't know.
Do you read about that? They took a couple.
Sorry? Anything that might be true, but that even looks close to a conspiracy theory, is something I just avoid.
No, this wasn't a conspiracy. I think this is my personal theory, that it was either the Chinese or the Russians trying to see how the system American system cope with it.
My understanding is that they used in retaliation for our Stux virus, they were trying to demonstrate to us that they could do the same thing. That's what they did. And again, the internet is pretty valuable now, and it's open season on that, and even our military depends on it, but it's actually quite fragile. So that's one of the weak points. And sure, the minute if you want to work at it hard enough, you can cause a lot of problems. These problems are actually in the category largely of mischief, but but that they're not material. They're mischief, but they can get a hold of information, and they have. And, I don't know. I don't care about that stuff. What I care about is.
But what they did, and it was interesting, is that they just attacked a couple of power stations. They attacked the.
There?
Sorry. Here we go. And that, they attacked a couple of transformers. They just shoot a couple of them.
Yep.
And that was enough to almost to take California electricity system to a limit. And it was actually just a couple of transformers.
Yeah, this is. Because we have the first, we have the worst power grid. We have had pretty serious problems with our power, and it's of course the key point of national weakness.
And also, somebody cut a big fiber optic cable in California, and they took a lot of the and the internet also in Mexico got affected because we connect through to America through the internet.
Thank you. So, the point is, it's really simple. This is your issue, right? Is it's really simple. Everybody wants me to talk about the subject more, but I actually feel it's kind of, it's so obvious, I don't know why I need to talk about it. And until it's a time for where people want to take action, I don't think it's,
It almost happened in Mexico.
It's
a month ago.
We had our riots in California not that long ago. We've had a number of things go on here. It doesn't take much, and we're sitting on our really big continental island over here. Europe has been brought to its knees before by Marxist terrorism. There's no reason why it won't be brought to its knees by Islamic terrorism again. No reason why we won't be. But there's no reason we can't just use that instead, that same weakness, in order to end all that terrorism and put ourselves in a better position. Anyway.
I missed all the revolutionary talk. God damn it.
Well, I try to avoid it, actually. I try to avoid it whenever possible.
We were talking about just examples of what happened here in Mexico. Yeah, what happened in...
This is all hypothetical, Kurt. Don't worry.
No, it happened. It was not a terrorism. I mean, it was a local demonstration in Mexico.
And the point is that we're at a time of great fragility in this world, we probably haven't been this fragile in the past. Certainly the last time we got to be anywhere close to this was the First World War. And before it took us until just a few years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, to catch up. It was longer, maybe it's more than that, 25 years now. But it took us a long time to catch up to the economic interrelations that we had prior to the First World War. I would think that we're going to have another episode where they're going to transition through this, a return to nationalism, and lower the tensions, or we're going to have some sort of global reaction. We're going to try to unify. And I don't think that's going to happen because America's not strong enough anymore to try to unify the world.
And America, I think, doesn't want to do it anymore.
And we don't want to do it. And frankly, there's an awful lot of the world that doesn't want us to do it. So I think that it's really, we did our job, which is we dragged humanity, except for the Muslims now, we dragged humanity kicking and screaming out of ignorance, poverty, starvation, and disease. And we did it, and we had the counter enlightenments of France, Germany, Eastern Europe, the Jews, the Chinese. We had those counter enlightenment revolutions. We had the second great wave of counter revolutions against us, which were the the Cosmopolitans again, the Jews, the Marx, Bose, Freud, you know, all the pseudoscientists. We had all that come together, and then finally culminating in the Frankfurt schools, various attacks on culture. And then we had the communism spread across the world as an attempt by backward societies to try to jump the gun and get ahead of more advanced societies. Then we had all that. Now we're sitting here with the Muslims being the last truculent people on this earth. But, I don't see that. I see that the logical result is that the great powers that are emerging are just not going to put up with these people anymore. And we'll get them all together, put them in place, and return to nationalism and try to build trade up. And if we don't do that, we're going to have a hell of a war. And what I think the different sides are basically under the presumption that, either it depends on whether we do what Obama did, which is create a vacuum that creates wars, or we do what the right wants to do, which is to gradually withdraw so that there's no opportunity for a great big power seizure. But, for example, Europe can learn how to take care of itself again.
Well, it's either that or they die in a war against Islam. That's it.
I kind of think we've all had enough, and that our generation is going to make sure this doesn't happen.
Hopefully, so, yeah. I think it's done either way. Even if Europe fails and it becomes part of the caliphate, the Chinese will exterminate them. The only reason that why the Chinese are not exterminating Muslims right now is because the West will get in its way.
Yeah, and we should be helping them.
And the Chinese hate them. I mean, the main issue they have is that Uyghurs.
Well, I mean, the Chinese are right. I mean, they're right. They're right, and we're wrong. I mean, We've been wrong a lot. That's the problem with Anglos, is that, we've spread this technology all over the world, but we dragged our stupid ideas with us. and this technology was really good, but everything else we think is a bunch of nonsense. And so we were on the wrong side in the First World War. We're on the right side and probably under communism, but everything we try to do is
in the Crimea War.
Yeah, we're on the wrong side a lot. So my attitude is, we're not too bright about this stuff. Let's just go back to, it's very simple rules: trade honestly and hold your contracts, and great. And if not, then beat the crap out of people, and that's not a very complex strategy. It works pretty well for everywhere in the world.
How is it that you always say, Kurt, that the Anglos were right, but the Anglos were wrong, but their methods were right, and the Germans were right, but their methods were wrong?
Correct. It's so frustrating when I look at history. We all have these great ideas, and we talk as if we're wise, and when you get far enough ahead in the future, you look back and it's like when you thought you were a kid and you thought you were a genius, and you're telling you off your ideas, you realize how stupid you were. And we look back at history, the great minds of history, and sometimes you look at these guys and God, I can't imagine you were that stupid. But but in their time, that's what they had to go by. But God, the fact that the Germans, they still have this, the oath is part of their culture. That's why it works. Yet every philosopher they have is a walking joke. I mean, these people are a comedy. They're great thinkers, so to speak, are a joke.
Especially the French.
And the French aren't even, they're so bad. They're not even funny. They're pathetic. I mean, Rousseau. I mean, where do you think Chomsky gets his bullshit from? I mean, he's a Rousseauian. He really believes that nonsense.
The noble savage.
Nothing good came from France after the French Revolution.
And Chomsky's, the thing about Rousseau is people don't realize he was a sick person. Right? He was a bad human being.
Rousseau or Chomsky?
Rousseau, and I said Chomsky.
Oh, Chomsky, not Trotsky.
And I'm like, Chomsky's just a really bad person, just like Rousseau. And he believes that nonsense for the same reason. I'm not sure he really believes it. I'm sure he's just a sick, twisted person. Anyway, and we have this whole, and you look back at history, and it's like, our Anglo ancestors, you know, these are my people, because my people were the Puritans. It's my family came over, you know, in the 1600s and settled Connecticut. You know what I mean? So
you were an immigrant, Goy. You were a refugee.
Fuck, dude. An invader. my family's been around for at least 1,000 years, and they're never immigrants. They're invaders.
Conquerors. Yep, conquerors.
conquering is good business, really.
And it was good for the Indians.
Huh?
And it was good for the Indians, at least in Mexico, when you compare what they were living in under before.
I don't know. I mean, I just look at it as there's more advanced societies and there's less advanced societies, and there's better genetic distributions and worse genetic distributions.
The Aztecs were horrible.
Yeah, they probably were horrible. I'd rather judge my own. You know, I'd rather criticize my own than criticize others.
But, also, the Aztecs are irrelevant now. We beat the shit out of them. Spain just annihilate them.
So, honestly, we just need to get back to what's real, the Arianism, which is, look, you know, a small number of people with advanced technology who can trust each other can, without too much effort, domesticate very large tracts of land with very large numbers of people, and over extended periods of time, produce amazing things that can't be produced by any other way. And we did a great job of it. We kind of were doing another job of it, not so good this time, up until the First World War. And we had our little suicide tribal interfamily war there and killed each other, and we left the job incomplete. Had we been able to complete that job, I think the world might have been able to skip what's happening right now.
What do you mean? You left it incomplete? Who did not got domesticated?
Well, we had colonized vast portions of this world and had most of it under control.
Oh, okay, I get it.
You know, yeah, we'd have just continued that process. We were slowly learning what not to do. I mean, there was some
back
really...
then. Remember, India was under British rule.
So was Africa. So was China, all of these people here in the Middle East. You know, they were a failed civilization. So what can we do? We could have actually taken control of this problem if we hadn't gone and killed each other, trying to get contain Germany and Russia. So, you know, honestly, we should have not contained Germany at all, and they and Russia would have normally settled their differences. Russia would have taken over Istanbul, and Turkey wouldn't exist today, and we would have continued to domesticate this world. I think we would have continued to learn from our mistakes, because the British were certainly doing so, and gotten a little more civilized about it and a little less out of hand about it. But we would have been able to bring everybody up. And instead, what we've had is we've had a century of horrific bloodshed because we didn't finish the job. Yet we gave everybody all the gifts, you know, all the technologies, but we didn't bring them along with us. We didn't.
No, the only civilizations that went along are the Asian ones, and that's it. Well,
but they don't need, right? They're like the non-problem ones. You know?
And they will never be a problem. They were even less violent than the whites. Well,
no, I don't know about that. They have.
I know. When they have wars, they're worse.
They have very violent people who have very little respect for humans.
Well, I think none of them have respect for humans. But...
Well, they're just activists than we are. So it's hard for them to, I don't know, sort of feel petty. Pity on like an individual. They're yeah, more like machine oriented, goal oriented. Like, oh, we just got to kill all these people, so we do no mercy,
well,
no nothing.
You know what it is that we have a pretty high, we have a wonderful language, and they don't. And we have a wonderful habit of telling the truth, and they don't. And we have a lot of public argument, in other words, a long culture history of rational public argument, and they don't. And so it's just a very different thing. So they solve by ritual, in other words, by indoctrination, but we solve by competition. And once you understand what they do, and that we do the opposite, but that both systems actually work for the creatures that they have, it makes complete sense. I just wish we'd stop fighting them. It's like the same problem we had in the First War. We're picking the wrong enemies. I mean, the Chinese and the Russians have the same objectives we do. It's the people in the middle that are the fucking problem.
But I think right now America is going to be friendlier with Russia. It might.
Well, it's hard because you can't. It's very hard to trust them because of the way they work. But it's true. It'll probably get better.
We have the same goal right now, which is keep the Islamists off our countries.
I don't know. You'd have to understand that Russia's goal is something near and dear to all of them, which is to be the core state of what they consider Orthodox civilization.
They also want to control the Black Sea, right?
Well, they have to for strategic reasons, but that's a strategic issue. And the other one is a spiritual or moral or destiny issue. You know, the Russians started out by one city at a time, destroying the Mongol Golden Horde and taking over the Golden Horde's empire. That's what Russia is, and then expanding all the way.
If they do that with Turkey, I mean, who cares? Who cares if they control Turkey?
No, we would like them to control Turkey, right? I mean, we have a meme in our sort of little tribe over here that we say we're not done until we've got Constantinople back.
Yeah, I mean,
that's right.
Yeah, I want them to control, as you said, to control Constantinople. And if they take also Lebanon back,
fine.
Yeah, I mean,
so Lebanon, Syria. If they get the Near East, that would be fantastic.
The problem is that Russia has an economy the size of Italy, and so she doesn't have the economy to do that. When she had the Soviet Empire, with the additional people of Ukraine primarily, but also the other ports, she had closer to a peerage with America in population. But now she has not that population, and she no longer has much of an economy, so she can't really do that. And so this is the problem she faces. So what we're stuck with is a Russia that longingly looks at Belarus and Ukraine, or at least, at least as far as Kiev, longingly looks at that as her domain and, you know, Orthodox civilization, and looks to the south as strategically. So I think that the thing is, you have, we can't, it's very hard for us to think like a Russian.
But we can have an understanding with them. I mean,
you can't have an understanding with a Russian. That's the problem, is that you can't. The way they think is a little different from the Chinese. The Chinese basically use deceive and delay. And what they do is what they're doing with these islands. They deceive and delay until you have no choice. That's how they win their wars. They always have. It's Sun Tzu. It's their first philosopher, isn't like us, Aristotle. Their first philosopher, Sun Tzu. And then they have Confucius and Lao Tzu on top of them. But first they have the delay and deceive. And that's why lying is okay in their culture.
Yeah.
When you come to Russia, they don't really have this. They have delay and seize. Their thing is to seize an opportunity. So the reason they have the north of China is because what they do is they put a whole bunch of tanks and or whatever, soldiers, on a basic area, and they wait for an opportunity. They're happy to wait 50 years, 100 years. But that day comes, they're going to take it, blame you for it, because you let chaos happen, and not give back their gains. So this is how they work, and this is why it's very hard to trust them. You know, my view is you have to get them engaged as a full partner, and we have to have a circumpolar strategy for the world that includes the Russians and the Chinese. And we need to stop looking at this as as we're competitors against each other, instead of that we're a unified civilization against the South. You know, because that's the real problem. Islam is the only problem left on Earth. You know, Hindus aren't a problem. Asians aren't a problem. The Muslim civilization is a problem. Yeah, Africans aren't a problem.
No, they're not, really.
The only problem civilization is really Islam.
Well, Africa is a force of nature more than a problem.
I don't. I cannot. I have gotten to understand those people, and you know, they're not a problem. They're a problem for them, but they're not a problem for the rest of us. Russia can be a problem. I'm from Ukraine for a long time. I know what Russians do. I don't want to see that happen to Ukraine again. I know what the Chinese do. I don't want to see that happen to anybody else. But if you look to the south, that's fine.
China will do it to Africa.
I don't know. There's no way to know that. What they're doing is, you got to remember, China looks like a big country, but it's a little skinny strip of green that's really highly populated, surrounded by deserts and seas that they're easily attacked over. They have not that many resources and a lot of people. So what they're doing is just what anybody would do in that condition. What the British did is, if you want to do that, you go buy up territories when you're rich. So when you're poor, you could use them. That's all they're doing.
But they also hate black people.
Huh?
They also hate black. I mean, they're very racist, against all races.
They think they're the best. They're you know, the same way the Jews think they're the best.
Yeah.
The Chinese think they're the best.
But they also consider blacks inhumans. If you talk to them in China,
I don't confuse silly cultural predispositions with strategic and military functions. Okay. So, you know, it's one thing if the average people think that, and it's another if the government and the business and military think that the way they're going to survive the coming problem they're facing is by using the wealth they have today to build as many opportunities as they can. And so that's what they think they're doing, and that's what they should be doing. If they weren't, you know, even the South China Sea, we have to understand that the way you kill China is you starve it to death, and the way you starve it to death is the South China Sea. So the reason they're building those islands out there is the same reason we didn't want to have the Russians in Cuba. It's purely defensive. We just don't like that they didn't, with the same reason the Russians. We prefer you say, we have to do this because it's too dangerous for us not, so we're going to do this. We realize it's really unacceptable to everyone, and we're sorry, but this is just a national interest thing. My same problem with Russia is that if he just said, he just made a call, he could have called up the heads of four Western nations, said, I really don't want to do this because I know it's going to hurt us, but I got to do this, and I hope you understand that it's got to be done for strategic reasons. And he'd have done it instead of with full admission, full public speech, instead of gone in there with his little green men bullshit. It would have been fine. He could have paid. He could have. Everyone in Ukraine wanted to get rid of Donbass. That's where all the shitty gangsters are from. Right? It's really true. It's where all the Russians imported their own people into that area. It's where the Russian military industrial complex was housed. So nobody wants them around because they're the ones who keep all the criminals in office. So that's what they wanted. But, you know, then you go and you come in and invade with little green men and kill their people, and now Ukrainians don't want to give it up. But if he hadn't done this, I'm going to pay you, you know, 20% off the price of oil for the next 100 years, plus forgive your $4 billion in debt. And that's your price for those two things, those two regions. And I have to do it. I'm sorry. At that point, you've made an uncomfortable, an unwilling bargain, but it's a bargain everybody can accept. Yeah,
like America did with Mexico after the war.
You can do things that people will deal with, right? There's ways to do it, and unfortunately, Chinese don't know how to do anything except lie. They don't know how to use the media, and the Russians know how to use media, but they just are not comfortable being straightforward. I mean, it's the same thing they had the problem when they couldn't get into NATO. They just believe some moron in the American State Department or even a politician is how you work with the United States, like how they work. You don't work that way. Look how the Jews work with it. I mean, Israel is the masters of it. You take your cause to the American people. The American people, like in the press, they like the underdog. They like to feel part of it. They sell the American people, and it's not a problem. Well, I mean, if Russians did that the way they're, you know, did that, and the Chinese did that, it would be fine. That's how we work in the West. Just be honest about it. It's this deceit that creates all the frustration.
Well, yeah, but that's not how it evolved. I don't think it's not only the culture. I think it's also in kind of in their genes for the Chinese. They've been doing it so long that it's.
I don't know, because I know too many Chinese Americans and, you know, third generation Asians over here. You can't tell them. I mean, they have a little lower verbal something or other you can sense, but they fit in just fine. I was just had another episode with somebody over Christmas where. I mean, this woman is just a scam artist, and in China it would be fine, but here it's illegal as hell, and she can't even grasp it. So,
Kurt, I have a question for you, because I know you're, I mean, you're aware of how the Jews act and behave, but you're not really an anti-Semite. Same as you're race aware and you understand, let's say, the biological strategies of different people, but you are not. A racist. You do not do racism. I know that
right.
Very well.
Yeah, I don't, because I don't. It's like, you know, a dog's a dog. It licks its balls. You know, I mean, what am I going to do? I mean, women are women. They act like women. I don't expect them to look good. I don't blame a dog for being a dog. I don't blame a woman for being a woman. I'm a man. I'm supposed to be in charge. We're men. We're supposed to be in charge. You don't let dog. You don't. You shoo the dog when it licks its balls in near your dinner table, and you tell women that they're out of line when they need to be told that. You don't let people come into your country and abuse your laws because they have lower trust ethics than you do. I mean, I don't look at it as their fault. I look at it as our fault.
Right. So what I wanted to ask you is that you don't see the, let's say, the sort of like a cultural HIV that Jewish ethics and cultural Marxism have spread among the West as the bigger issue. So
of course I see it as a bigger issue. I just
than
see
Islam?
It as
than Islam. So you think that we have to deal with the sort of like HIV first?
It's just the male and female version of the same strategy. I mean, okay. Judaism is a female version and Islam is a male version. They're both the same. Same genetic strategies basic strategies as parasitic strategies from the opposite ends. And I know that those people are evolved from tribal called pastoralists, right? They didn't evolve from farmers. I don't know if it's genetic or not, but I know that what they're like. And so I looked at, was it their fault? I mean, is it their fault? I mean, I don't. It's not their fault. Well, it's our fault for letting them in here.
That wasn't the angle I was going for.
Okay.
I mean,
go ahead.
I think you're right. No, I was just going to ask you if you think Islam or Jews are the bigger problem. Like, if we didn't have Jews screwing up our culture, Islam wouldn't. Islam hasn't taken anything we haven't given to it, and we gave them,
just like the Roman world. Just like the Roman world, the Roman world was conquered through women. And the modern world is conquered through women. The Roman world was sold a lie by the Jews in Christianity, and the modern world, women have been sold a lie by the Marxists. Whose fault is that?
Holy shit! Now I just realized that's the basic story of Genesis: Adam and Eve, women. Like we lost.
Dude, there's three motives. In somewhere around 1500, we see. Whether they're our ancestors or our conquerors, put bronze, the bronze from Armenia, the wheel definitely from Europe, and the horse probably from Afghanistan. Put those three technologies together, made a chariot, and they went around and they were now had velocity. In other words, it's hard for us to imagine this era where we have cars, what it means when you can actually do you can actually cover territory with a horse. Instead of on foot, I mean, you have, it's the equivalent of not just tank, but of a jet fighter. And so they had that, and they put those three things, and they realized, well, you know what happened out of that? Those people changed from worshiping the earth and mothers and all this past stuff to sky worshiping paternal. I mean, they develop property, all those institutions that we take for granted. They develop sovereignty, heroism, contractualism. That stuff all came out of that movement. And religion was what the losing sides invented. So they invented lying to ally each other against the strong. So the aristocracy on one side and mysticism on the other. Well, you know, we fight these wars, whatever, we have another dark age, you come up together, and now we've got Greek reason and Babylonian and Jewish mysticism and Egyptian mysticism. And they conquer us, our women, that way. And then we go through another dark age where the Muslims come in and they basically destroy the European economy and make North Africa out of white civilization. And they finally actually get up into the ball and basically narrow us down into a little corner of Northern Europe. And then the English reinvent the next step, which is empiricism. And we use that technology and that weapons to go out and push them all back. You know, and I'm like, this is the third goddamn time. Then they come back with Marxism. So, I mean, are we going to learn? You know,
stop. What you're saying, Kurt, is that you want to propose a solution that makes any further solution, useless. Like, you don't need any further solutions. That's what you're saying. You want a solution that's like the last solution.
I don't want to say the final solution because then I'm going to get in trouble. I want to complete the project of the West. We call it science, but it's actually truth telling. And I want to complete that and institutionalize it. Because the minute those people can't lie, they're done. That's their weapon.
Isn't it enough that we know they're lying?
It's not enough to know the lie. It's you got to punish liars. You got to domesticate. Okay. We incrementally suppressed violence, then theft, then fraud, then conspiracy. And now we've got to incrementally suppress deceit, propaganda, pseudoscience, pseudo-rational, mysticism, political correctness. We can kill this all the way we killed every other crime in history. The fact that we don't consider it a crime is simply a mistake. Just like people back then, you can go to other parts of the world still today where they think fraud is acceptable, usury is acceptable, and slavery is acceptable because they can get away with it. So nobody appreciates having some way that they scam other people eliminated. But that's what we've done. We domesticate man by eliminating, incrementally suppressing every means of parasitism as we discover it. Well, you know, we were wrong. We thought that everybody would learn. Everybody could join the aristocracy like us. They can't. So what do we got to do? We got to incrementally increase the suppression of parasitism. And at this point, if we crush lies, which is basically what testimonialism does, if we make it impossible to lie, very difficult to lie and not get prosecuted, then they have no weapons. Then they have to resort to what we do. We've done to everybody else through our 3,000 years and 500 years of history is we force people to gradually enter into the market because they have no other means of survival. We took crime off, and we took violence off, we took theft off, we've taken all these things off the shelf. They have nothing to worry. We just need to take propaganda and deceit off the shelf, especially since it's been industrialized. And that's what I'm trying to do. Now, it takes a long time for me to get this idea across. Thankfully, you guys do understand it. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to put an end to this every thousand-year problem we have of them inventing a lie that seduces our people.
So, are we going to win?
I'm determined to win. The only way to know if you're going to win is you're going to have more fun killing them than they have fun killing you. I mean, it's just all it is.
Okay. Beto, you have anything to say?
I'm listening.
You're listening?
I really don't have a question. So,
like, yeah, we know you. We just want to talk. We just want you to talk, Kurt.
Okay. Well, I had a lot of fun. I am, though, however, at the point where I'm keeping people here awake. So, yep. I'd kind of like to wrap up pretty quick.
That's what I was going to ask you. I remember you said that you need to be done at 9. It's now 9:40. So let's just end it right here. I think that the we will win. It's a nice conclusion. Cavernario had to leave, and so he's not here with us now. So I don't know, Kurt. Any parting words?
No, I really enjoyed this because you know enough that you know you have not a lot of knowledge, and so it was easy for me to talk. I think I was speaking a little more to my friends instead of so professionally. Maybe that was a mistake or not, but I really enjoyed this conversation. So I hope it sounds like the round the table conversation over beer that we were all hoping to have. All right.
Awesome. And you're welcome. Yep. Well, you're welcome any other time, and you're welcome in my home. If you're ever around, that I mean it. If you want to have the literal beer round table, any day.
Okay, brother. Thank you very much. Love you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Thank you, Kurt. Bye-bye. See you guys.
Bye.
Sabe de mí y yo soy parte de todos, nada cambiará con un aviso de curva en sus caras. Veo el temor, ya no hay fábulas en la ciudad de la furia. Buenos Aires. prefieres esta noche.